nobody's doing the mountaineer view, which is quite a unique perspective because everything's falling away below your feet.
From Wyoming Public Media, this is the Modern West. I'm Micah Schweitzer. So, for many of us, the words Western art conjure up images of cowboys on horseback with majestic mountain backdrops. But as we'll hear on this episode, that's not the whole picture. We'll start with a cocktail of art and science mixed up by University of Wyoming professor Jeff Lockwood. As the so-called U-cross pollination experiment revealed, it is in fact possible for scientists and artists to team up to create something unique. As a creative writer and an entomologist, Lockwood's own career straddles the arts and the sciences. So he mixed up 8 of his colleagues for 11 days in the summer of 2014 at the U-cross Foundation to see what might happen.
4 scientists and 4 artists walk into a bar. The bartender lines up bottles of ecology, geology, physiology, microbiology, dance, sculpture, music, and poetry, along with glasses shaped to hold playfulness, intimacy, confusion, and urgency. Then he tells them to make themselves a drink.
But Lockwood says there was no guarantee the drinks would actually taste any good.
I thought that with 4 pairs that we would have a really good chance at one of them working well, 2 of them working sort of, and 1 of them maybe not completely blowing up.
In the end, though, he says all the scientist-artist pairs came up with exciting projects.
And something that could not have been done otherwise.
Like a rock opera, pardon the pun, about Powder River Basin geology. Some projects, like the opera, look more like art, some more like science, like a project between a physiological ecologist and a dance choreographer. Michael Dillon studies honeybees, how they forage in flowers, and how pesticides affect them. And if you watch bees closely, you see that they move in very particular ways. But scientists don't have a good way to notate those movements. Choreographers, like Rachel Shaw, do. It's called Laban movement analysis. Shaw says it's like sheet music for motion instead of sound.
There's a way to write down movements. And not just the literal physical thing that's happening, but the qualitative parts of it as well.
I could show you 2 boxes with bees, and you could look at one and look at the other, and you could tell me this one's sick. But you may not be able to tell me exactly what it is about the way those bees are moving that makes them seem sick. Mm-hmm. And this approach allows us to kind of do that.
Shaw has adapted Laban movement analysis to show how the bees in Dillon's experiments are moving differently. So Shaw, the artist, helps Dillon, the scientist, to discover new data.
I mean, I feel like I see new things. I'm doing stuff that I wouldn't have otherwise done were it not for this collaboration.
They plan on publishing a paper about their study, probably the first one ever co-authored by a physiological ecologist and a choreographer, and to create a dance concert to convey the findings to the public. For another study that germinated at the U-cross pollination experiment, Dillon is working with sculptor Ashley Hope Carlisle to make research about bumblebees accessible to the public through interactive sculptures. And the National Science Foundation is funding that project to the tune of nearly $500,000. Jeff Lockwood says that's partly because the science is being translated through art.
So by combining the arts with the sciences, they became much more competitive for NSF funding because science has to be in discourse with the public.
On the other hand, last year when Lockwood was looking to fund the U-cross pollination experiment, some potential funders balked at the idea.
Wait a minute. This is vague. It's uncertain. We don't know exactly what's going to happen. You haven't described the products. And I said, well, exactly. That's exactly it.
Because, he says, this kind of work is risky. He knew it going into the experiment. It might not work. And many scientists and artists are stuck in their disciplines, as Rachel Shaw and Michael Dillon have discovered.
My colleagues are like, what is this thing? This is crazy. And her colleagues are the same thing. Why are you wasting your time interacting with the scientists?
But Jeff Lockwood also points out no risk, no reward. and Lockwood wants UW to embrace that attitude. He'd like the university to rethink the old divide between the arts and the sciences. Choreographer Rachel Shaw agrees.
And this is like a really big statement to make, but I feel like the boxes that we've been put in our society, it served us for a while, but I feel like as a culture, it's not serving us anymore.
And through the UCross pollination experiment, maybe a new vision for the university is blooming. Next up, we'll explore the works of two of the state's more extreme artists. Most people paint mountains with a view from the valley, but over four decades, Laramie artist Joe Arnold has summited Wyoming peaks in order to capture the view from the top. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards joined him for a climb.
I join 62-year-old artist Joe Arnold and his dog Rufio on a trek up 12,000-foot Medicine Bow Peak. As we hike, I wonder if Arnold considers himself more of a mountaineer who paints or a painter who climbs mountains. There's a difference, I think. Today, the sky hangs gloomy with smoke from distant fires, but this doesn't worry Arnold.
Glass can be great for composition.
As we hike, he tells me about growing up with divorced parents on two coasts, his artistic mother in Washington, D.C., his outdoorsy dad in Los Angeles, who took him mountaineering in Wyoming every summer. But for a long time, his love for art and mountains stayed separate.
At Philadelphia College of Art, I was doing subways and architecture. Towards the end of my college degree, we were going back into the mountains. I thought, nobody's doing the mountaineer view, which is quite a unique perspective because everything's falling away below your feet. You're dealing with this downward space. So it's quite different than standing in a scenic turnout where most Teton paintings are done and you're looking up at the mountain.
Do you consider yourself a pretty good mountaineer as well?
Well, I have a long resume, but I don't put up new routes. So I'm not an innovator that way. I consider my art to be where I put the most innovation. And I think it's still, for me, the greatest challenge.
It's more challenging than climbing the mountain?
Yeah.
We reach the saddle and take a breather. So
yeah,
so tell me some of the mountains that you have painted from the top. So.
Yeah, I love the Grand. I love Mount Moran. That's been a great one. The Tetons in general are great to paint from because not only is there one main peak, but there's other peaks that will fill up part of the composition. And it's not just like space. You know, Switzerland was really beautiful. I got a lot of great pastels from that trip. In Bolivia, I think the highest pastel I ever did was at 18,000 feet. A couple of people wanted to buy that pastel. I'm not ready to part with it.
Why is that?
Well, that's pretty impressive to have a pastel that you did in a place like that.
So it's not like a photograph of taking a picture up there. What's the difference between one of these pastels and just taking a photograph?
That is a good question because I think there's more of you invested and you had to stay there and study everything and watch the clouds move in and out.
And it's these pastel drawings that he takes home and turns into full-sized oil paintings. Huge paintings, some 4 by 6 feet or larger. Is there times when you're like actually on ropes in doing some of these pastels?
Yeah, I was up at Long's Peak, but a gust of wind came along and I was taking a selfie with the pastel in my hand, the picture. The wind grabbed that pastel and board out of my hand and it flew over this cliff. And I couldn't get to that one. So I went back to town and grabbed some friends. We went back up there and rappelled down to the pastel and retrieved it. It was quite a rescue.
Why do you feel like you need to go to that effort for a pastel?
Well, and it's again that engagement with the mountain, and it's the act of painting that is what I remember in the studio.
Well, we should probably get up there, huh?
Well, I think so, yeah.
Okay.
Interesting clouds.
We finish climbing the steep switchbacks to the summit, and Arnold unpacks his art supplies.
This is my little pastel rig.
He sits down in his blow-up chair and starts sketching the iconic view of Medicine Bow's cliff face. Lakes glitter far, far below.
That seems somewhat precarious to me.
It does, but this chair will fill in all gaps. Okay. This isn't ideal for grabbing the pastels, but it'll work.
He works fast with chalk-like pastels using an impressionist's technique, little swipes and dashes of color that all suddenly pop to life before my eyes.
Most landscapes, you're kind of looking up at these mountains.
Yeah. You know, usually you'd have a horizon line here, and then the mountains would be up here.
So the horizon line is more in the
middle. Yeah, the horizon line's up here.
At the top.
In fact, I'm going to put it in right there. And then the mountains are down below it. So that's one of the immediate differences that you see in the mountaineer's view. Now what's cool is that blue right against the cliff. That is a rich color. You know, on this gray sort of day, we're going to want to emphasize some of these colors. Okay, well, let's call that good.
All right, that's beautiful.
Well, wow. Thank you.
Do you think it's something you'll be able to use back in the studio?
Oh, you bet. This is very fun stuff to paint. And
how are you going to make sure that this doesn't smudge and get ruined on the hike back out?
That's a very important question. And what I do is I put this glassine over the pastel, and it doesn't pick up color. It's like a wax paper almost.
Arnold tucks the little picture away, and we start down the mountain. I wonder if I'll see it in oils in the near future. A smoky day over Medicine Bow Peak. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
Here's another artist creating new views. Self-labeled as the reluctant product of an evangelical Christian upbringing, Jackson artist Aaron Wallace brings to life the ideals of Martin Luther, who believed that we are simultaneously saints and sinners. So in his art, Wallace places drug dealers and gang leaders in the context of Christian iconography. I spoke with Wallace about how his upbringing and his love of hip-hop have influenced his work.
I felt there was a lot of similarities between the early Christian church, the apostles, how they were kind of persecuted by the Roman political authority, and how drug dealers and other people, criminals, are kind of persecuted by the political authority in America. Our current class structure singles people like that out through the criminal justice system. So I kind of felt that there was also this element of like martyrdom and persecution, especially with like rappers that end up getting killed and murdered, you know, that was worth exploring.
And putting these people in the context of illuminated manuscripts and iconography raises this question of who is good and who is moral, because you're often highlighting in the text that accompanies these the systems of oppression that they're caught in. So you have a guy, Stanley Tookie Williams, who talks about how he was abused by guards in prison. And so the whole moral structure is now in question.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of moral subjectivity in the criminal justice system. I think if you ask most people, at least most middle class or affluent white people, they have this idea that the criminal justice system kind of represents what's right and what's moral, and that we have kind of laws to, you know, uphold what's right and what's moral. And, you know, I kind of take a little more of, I guess, maybe a Marxist view that laws are kind of created to uphold the class structure, and that laws aren't necessarily based on what's moral or what's right, especially, yeah, like how Tookie Williams was tortured for 2 years, drugged and tortured in the LA County jail by sheriff's deputies, you know, the people who are supposedly upholding the law.
Another interesting case is Felix Mitchell Jr. He was an Oakland drug kingpin and was apparently much beloved in his community.
You know, Mitchell ran the San Antonio Village housing projects, essentially controlled the neighborhood he built basketball courts, you know, he ran a program to feed people. He bought groceries for people. He paid people's rent when they couldn't make their rent, you know. So he was really, you know, regarded as with a lot of respect in the community as like a philanthropist and a person who really cared about the people that society had forgotten.
But helping people while also ruining other people's lives. I mean, in the case of Mitchell, he's selling $800,000 worth of drugs in a week.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. But I feel like, again, that brings us to an area of moral subjectivity where perhaps Freeway Rick Ross is a better way to example of illustrating it. Freeway Rick Ross was buying his cocaine from Daniela Blandone, who was a CIA informant. And Daniela was essentially trafficking Oliver North's cocaine in the Iran-Contra scandal. So, you know, Freeway Rick Ross was getting his cocaine from the United States government, and he rose to become the biggest drug dealer on the West Coast. And he never could have done it without the complicity of the CIA.
Aaron Wallace, the images that you're creating in this print series, The Street Bible, draw on Christian iconography. And you say in your biography on your website that you are the reluctant product of an evangelical Christian upbringing. Does that play any role in choosing this style of art?
Oh, I feel it plays a huge role. My dad works for Pat Robertson, the Christian televangelist who ran the 700 Club through most of the 80s. And, you know, I grew up in this very right-wing evangelical family. So, you know, I started listening to rap music in junior high school, you know, and hip-hop was kind of one of my first, you know, ways that I got introduced to the real world, or the world outside what I was allowed to see and listen to in the church. Hip-hop was really responsible for me questioning a lot of the values that I kind of had beat into me as a kid. You know, I still reference, I feel, that kind of Christian past in the work. The work is, you know, on my part, kind of an attempt to identify and just deal with this incredibly repressed Christian childhood I had and, you know, kind of insert something into that canon of Christian iconography that the people who originally created that type of art would have never imagined.
And how did your family react to you listening to hip-hop in junior high?
They found my tapes and they threw them out. They destroyed them all. We would have these long conversations about the kind of subversive moral values and sexual promiscuity that black culture promotes and, you know, all these other sort of things and just drug use and all of these other sort of things, even though I had no idea what drugs were at that time.
So how do they respond to your work, The Street Bible?
I think that they'd probably prefer I was making impressionist paintings or something. But I think that if, you know, you really got down to it, they probably wouldn't approve of a lot of the subject matter or the fact that I'm, you know, essentially deifying drug dealers and gang leaders and rappers in the work.
Who do you think needs to see this art?
I think that Jackson is actually a good place to be making art like this because I think that Jackson's a very affluent, upper-class white community. I feel that it's art that needs to be seen by a lot of people because it addresses these core issues of class inequality and, you know, social status that are becoming so relevant in our society today.
Aaron Wallace, thanks so much for your time.
Oh, yeah, thank you very much.
Wyoming isn't only known for visual art, it also has a vibrant music scene. Here's Jackson Hole's own One Ton Pig, and this performance of Just a Word is from a live studio performance.
One, two, three, four. Soldier early morning, shaking memories of taking calls. I'm the type of person who remembers faces. especially if I'm looking up from afar. He said your hand has flown before me, bouncing all this after my will. I'm in a foreign place with no direction. I need a reason to stay at home. Just a mood in the right direction. Just a step in the stone. I'm a face of multi-complexion. Just a word that's come before. From a line of Williams and Guthrie. Breed a dog that's dying hard. Telling stories cause they need to be heard. Searching hope from afar. Just a mood in the right direction. Just a step in the stone. I'm a face of multi-complexion. Just a word that's come before. German mother's love, scorned by father's words. I hit out in all directions. All direction is led me back home. I'm just a soldier in the early morning. I got family back in Iowa. I'm a songwriter who loves the world. Not as much as I love my own. Just a mood in the right direction. Just a step in the stone. I'm a face of multi-complexion. Just a word that's come before. Just a word that's come before. Just a word that's come before.
Like what you're hearing, you can hear more of One Ton Pig's performance and watch videos from our studio session series at our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org. Now let's listen in on a conversation between Wyoming poet David Romvet and his wife Margot Brown. David talks about some of the struggles of moving to the West as a communist and a poet. Romvet served as Wyoming's poet laureate from 2003 to 2011.
So when our daughter was a tiny baby, I would walk her up and down the street quite often. I'd carry her in a little backpack or bicycle her in a trailer. And it was winter one day, I remember, about 24 below, and we were doing errands on Main Street. And at almost every shop, a woman would come out and she'd say, "You get that baby in out of the cold! That is too cold for that baby! You don't be walking around at 24 below with a baby in a backpack!" And I just remember so all these stories about the baby in town, because other people in the summer, when I'd be walking with her in the trailer, on the bike, or walking with a carriage, or in the backpack, people would come up all the time, and they knew that we were in the Basque community, in a Basque family. And they would say, "Oh, she's so beautiful, and she just looks so Basque." Well, of course, there's no Basque blood in her. I mean, she's culturally growing up in a Basque American community, but there's no genetics of Basque because Simon, her grandfather, was Margot's stepfather. But I love that people would just say that. She's so Basque.
Well, and I remember when the ladies all yelled at you about it being so cold, you were so mad at them because you knew how to take care of your baby. But I remember thinking, well, it's kind of nice to live in a community where everybody watches out for everyone. And the first time Caitlin wanted to walk to my mom's house by herself, it's just two blocks. She was 5 years old, and she really wanted to walk by herself. And so I said she could. And I kind of spied on her until she was out of sight. My mother was spying on her from the other end. It's just two blocks, you know. And she said all these people came out of their houses and asked her if she was okay. She said, I know I'm not supposed to talk to strangers. But people kept coming out and saying, are you okay?
I mentioned just briefly that my own childhood was not a happy one with a father who was not really equipped to be a very good father. And Margaret was told how funny it is that her stepfather, Simon, was in some ways maybe a little difficult guy too for Margaret and her brother, Mike. But when I came along as a young adult moving here, he was a fantastic father. He took me under his wing and he took me kind of into ranching. Now, it's also important to know that I came here as a poet, not exactly a sort of central economic function in Wyoming life. Yes.
And not only a poet, but a vegetarian poet.
Oh, yes, a vegetarian poet.
That's even
worse. Oh, and there was another, there was worse than that. There was the vegetarian communist poet.
Oh, yeah.
Coming to Wyoming. And so I was held, there was a little suspicion about my presence in the life of this young woman, Margot Brown. But Simon took me kind of into working with him. And so I became, because I was younger and could spend a lot more time scrambling and climbing, did windmill maintenance. When I first came here, the 4 Mile Ranch had 19 working windmills to bring water to the surface for stock, right? Watering cows or sheep. Sheep was just kind of at the tail end when I came here, and it was more cattle. But I simply spent a lot of time up on windmill towers, 30 to 50 feet in the air, with a belt like a bosun's kind of chair in sailing, hanging off the back of this windmill, trying to uncrank things with one hand and push on something else, and covered with grease. And the platforms were always greasy from a lot of windmills throw oil. They're not really built with great gaskets in some of the joined parts, so oil gets thrown and it's a mess. Worked with him a lot. And he came to feel really strongly, I think, that, he might be a poet and a communist and a vegetarian, but he can work.
He really respected you.
To be a really big part of life here. I remember feeling as though it was kind of the old joke about, well, you may be a poet, but if you can fix fence, you're okay. It's fine. And people didn't care. And that seems to me a central part of one of the most positive aspects of Wyoming life, which is a sense of live and let live that I understand to be really important in our history. And if we want to get along in small communities where you know everyone and you may not necessarily agree with your neighbor on social or political issues, but you're going to be in close contact all the time. And so suddenly it was like work was a bond.
I loved working at the ranch, mostly because I loved horses so much. And he always called me his top hand, and I would go out. The first time I rode with him, I got on Black Dynamite. We rode, he said we probably rode 25 miles that day, because we'd ride the cabin, from the cabin to the river was 7 miles, and we ride this giant pasture and got all the sheep. And I remember thinking I could ride forever, even though my knees hurt and I would get tired. I loved horses so much, I could just do that forever. We were in this big pasture, and all my cousins and everyone was riding, they were riding the perimeters and bringing sheep from all over to the center, and I was supposed to head them towards the corrals. And they were very wild because they weren't used to people, and they ran over a whole bunch of hills ahead of me. And at some point, they got too far ahead, and I couldn't find them. I was hysterical. I was crying and hunting for the sheep, and my Uncle Johnny came, and I said to him, I can't find my sheep. And he was so kind. He just said, oh, little Bo Peep lost her sheep, huh? And he went, and of course, it's hard to lose several thousand sheep, and he found them. And we
That's maybe. A great idea. I lost the... It's really hard to lose
But I'm pretty good at losing things. So he found the sheep for me, and I was so grateful to him. Another time I rode a horse, Jigs. I rode him into a bog, and the cows had crossed this bog. We had this reservoir, and I saw, I couldn't figure out where to cross it, but I saw cow tracks across. And so I thought, well, I guess I have to cross it here. And I crossed, and the horse went up to his shoulders in mud and was stuck and couldn't get out. I stood up, walked across his back, and leaped to the shore and started yelling. When the family came, they had to get a horse, a couple horses, rope him and pull him out. And my mom said the saddle was so covered with mud and muck that smelled so bad that our basement smelled bad for months because she'd cleaned it and put it down there. It was
That's
really,
pretty intense.
And then I heard later that the cows have, because their hooves are cloven, they can cross where horses can't. So that was
a good thing to learn after it happened, isn't it?
And poor Jigs, he never trusted me again.
That's David Romvet speaking with Margot Brown. The story was produced by Rebecca Huntington. We'll wrap up this episode with the story of how one man realized a childhood dream. Jonas Sloniker reflects on how he turned around the disappointment of a childhood Christmas decades later.
I don't think I always wanted a paint set, but when my mom asked me what I actually wanted, I said, yeah, I want a paint set. When I was 12 or 13, and I was excited. Well, I did get a paint set, but it wasn't the paint set I'd been lying awake dreaming about at night. So for that Christmas, I got a paint set that was two kind of hard canvases with paint-by-numbers clown faces surrounded by a fake black velvet. And I was kind of shocked because I was picturing empty somethings, empty canvases or boards and paints and brushes, and there was paint-by-numbers clown faces. One looked like Bozo the Clown. He had really big, like, poofy hair and, yeah. I don't like Christmas. I'll admit it. My therapist in January of 2011 was exploring that with me, saying, talk to me about why you don't like Christmas. And I said, well, I never really got anything I wanted when I was a kid. And he's like, tell me a story of that, what happened. And I sat there for a minute, and then I remembered this paint set story. And I told him that story, and then he looked at me and he said, so, Jonas, why don't you buy yourself a paint set? Which was like a light bulb went off in my head, like, oh, wow, I can buy myself a paint set. So my birthday was coming up January 29th, and I thought maybe I'll go buy myself a paint set, and I got a little excited, and then there was another voice in my head that was like, yeah, you're turning 56, and you're going to buy yourself a paint set and start painting. Really? But I didn't listen to that voice. I went out, I brought myself some brushes, tubes of acrylic paint, some Frederick's canvas sheets, and I sat down on January 29th, 2011, my 56th birthday, and started painting. It was awesome. It was really awesome. I started crying. And then I think I was angry, and then at one point I was laughing. All these emotions poured through me, but they came out on the canvas. It was like I was painting what I was feeling. I was painting what was inside me, and I couldn't stop painting. If there's something in your heart that you really want to do like this, it's not too late, you know? Do it. Whatever it is, you want to play an instrument, you want to paint, you want to skydive, you want to learn how to garden, you know, do it. It's the best therapy I've ever done in my life. I'm painting for me. I'm painting for my transformation. I'm painting for my growth. I'm painting for emotional breakthroughs and magic and miracles. And I mean, it's like breathing air.
That's Laramie artist Jonas Sloniker. And that's it for this edition of The Modern West. You can catch our next episode on the third Tuesday of the month. And if you like what you hear, we'd appreciate a positive rating. In the meantime, you can find lots more stories about The Modern West at our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org. Samuel Sanders produced the podcast. Anna Rader is our web editor. The theme music is by Jeff Troxell, and I'm Micah Schweitzer. The Modern West is a production of Wyoming Public Media.